Thanks. What I'd like to do tonight is talk about the nature of limited government, why you should care about it, and how it is that, the fact that it's a Christian invention. Limited government is not something that pagan societies, unbelieving societies gravitate to. They are repelled by the thought. Limited government is a distinctively Christian development, and I want to explain how that happened, why it matters, and what your response to that should be when we are confronting some of the challenges in our culture today, which is a clash, largely, what are popularly called the culture wars, are actually wars between those who want limits on government and those who want no limits on government. That's fundamentally the clash, and there's a deep theological reason underneath those two sides. It's not just an arbitrary or a capricious. It's not just that people happen to be on this side and people happen to be on that side. There are deep worldview reasons, theological reasons for this. So, the Christian faith, in broad outlines, tells us that God created everything. God made everything. That means that there is a fundamental divide between creator and creature, right? So in the beginning, God created. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. So when that verb created hits, all of a sudden, where there used to be one God, there are now two things, right? There's creator and created. Now, the Christian faith has historically denied stoutly that the creation is an emanation from God or a development of God, or it's that we've denied that it's part of God. Rather, it's like a painter and a painting, a sculptor and the sculpture that he does. God is the artist, and the creation is the artwork. So one theologian, Peter Jones, has said the fundamental division theologically is between what's called oneism, what he calls oneism, and twoism. Oneism and twoism. The Christians are the twoists, right? We believe that there are two kinds of reality. There's uncreated reality and there's created reality, and created reality is contingent. It's dependent for its existence on the will of the Creator. Before God spoke, nothing was there. When he spoke, it obeyed by showing up. Everything, let there be light, and there was light. The oneist believes that what is basically morphs over time, but there's only basically one reality. There's one reality. Oneists might be materialistic atheists. They might be pantheists. But basically, they're saying that there is no fundamental distinction or divide. Now, the Christian faith says that God created, and when God created, there was now another thing. There was now another reality, created, contingent reality. Now, the Bible tells us in the early chapters of Genesis, by chapter 3, our first parents had been put in the garden, and were told by God, under no circumstances were they to eat from the tree in the middle of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They disobeyed, and sin entered the world. Sin entered the world when Adam obeyed his wife, followed his wife, took the fruit, and ate it. So we have two realities going on. We are, one, creatures. All of us here are creatures. There was a time when you were not. Right? There was a time when you were not. We're creatures. Our existence is finite, limited, bounded, contingent. So we're creatures. But not only that, we're also fallen creatures. We inherited a propensity to sin from our first parents. The world is, taking one thing with another, a screwed up place. Right? The world does not run smoothly. The world has got there are a lot of appalling evil deeds that are being perpetrated on a large scale all over the world as we speak. So we are created and we are fallen. And now introduce the next problem. There are billions of us. created limited, contingent, finite beings, and we're fallen, basically self-centered, self-absorbed, conceited, proud, and billions of us. And that presents the immediate problem that comes up is who is going to direct traffic? We have all these billions of people running around like somebody kicked an ant farm, right? Everybody's scurrying, everybody's doing their thing, and people look at this and say, that's chaos. What are we going to do? What are we going to do about it? Somebody needs to organize this place. Somebody needs to take a firm hand with these critters. We need to make it more productive. We need to streamline this. And there are people in the world who feel like they are the anointed ones. They've got the insight and the knowledge and the savvy that enables them to direct the traffic of all these billions of finite, limited, sinful, self-absorbed creatures who are scurrying all over the place. Now, William Buckley once defined a liberal as someone who, when you're taking a shower, reaches in and adjusts the temperature for you. Here, I don't think you're doing it quite right. But it's worse than that. They don't only adjust the temperature. That was a bad choice of words. They do not merely adjust the temperature. They also dictate how much water can come out of the shower head, how big the water tank can be, what the water pressure can be. They've got all kinds of rules because you're a scurrying little ant and we need to run your life. So we are sinners. So how does a Christian respond to this? Well, some Christians say, well, we're fallen and sinful and we've got all these problems. Don't we deserve to have someone bossing us around? Didn't we ask for it when we rebelled against God? Well, yes, I think we do deserve to be bossed around. I don't think we merit our freedom. The problem is the people who are doing the bossing are in exactly the same position that we're in. They're also finite, fallen, limited, bounded, contingent. They've got all the same limitations that we do, plus power over other human beings, which is a bad combination. It's like giving whiskey to a 2-year-old, which is not done if you don't do that. So, now, hit the pause button on that. That's the theological backdrop that I'm setting up. Now, fast forward. Many contemporary evangelical Christians have a very emaciated view of history and church history. Okay, so if you ask a modern pop evangelical, when did your church start? You know, 1978, I think it was, when our pastor came to town and planted the church. That's how far back they go. And not just Christians, but contemporary Americans, think of history like a series of ponds. You know, there's the pond called the 80s. And people lived around the pond in the 80s. And there were people lived around the pond called the 50s. And they've got it parsed out in decades. And generally, their awareness, it starts to fade away in the early 20th century. I think about as far back as people go is the 20s, right? I've got some idea of the 20s. The 50s, the 80s, and then you've got photographs of your parents in one of those living in the weird clothing they had. But before you get on your high horse, ye sinners, 30 years from now, your kids are going to be looking at photographs of you dressed exactly the way you are tonight, and they're going to and they're going to think it's hilarious. just put a pin in that. All right, back on track. So we have, but in reality, history, and in reality, church history is a river. It's not a series of ponds. It's a river, And what happens upstream matters downstream. What happens upstream affects all of us. One of the things that happened over the course of church history over the last 2,000 years, which also erase from your mind any notion that church history is a function of people walking around with the holy glow, you know, early church martyrs with the, yes, you know, and the weird voiceovers and there's a saintly glow and church history. The more you learn about it, the more it resembles a 2,000-year-old cafeteria food fight. So, but there are good guys and bad guys in the cafeteria food fight. There are many blessings that have come out of it over the long haul, but God is sovereign, as you've probably heard me say. God is sovereign, and he draws straight with crooked lines. So the Christians are those who were redeemed out of this condition that the whole human race was in, but they were not redeemed instantaneously. They've got a lot of gunk and assumptions and background assumptions that they had in the world before they were converted, and that caused problems, and the church fought off heresies, and I love Chesterton's comment where the church comes down to the present reeling but erect, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really striking thing. Well, one of the things that developed over the course of church history were conflicts between the pagan outlook on government, right? Pharaoh's idea. Pharaoh says, I own Egypt, and if I want a pyramid, I get a pyramid. And if you don't want to work on the pyramid, that's too bad. I will make you work on the pyramid. And that's how Pharaoh offered full employment. So Pharaoh offers full employment. So you have Pharaoh, you have Caesar, you have all of these unbelieving rulers who basically claim to be gods walking on earth. They don't have a sense of limitation on their authority. Okay? When the Christian church arrived on the scene, the first sign of trouble the thing that caused trouble for the Christians, the reason the Christians were persecuted, the reason Christians were thrown to the lions, was not religious in the Roman sense of the word, it was political. Okay? The problem was that the Christians were political troublemakers because they would not confess that Caesar was Lord. They would be dutiful citizens, they would pay their taxes, like it says in Romans 13, they would drive on the right side of the road, they were conscientious citizens across the board, but they wouldn't offer a pinch of incense to the spirit of Caesar and the genius of Rome. They wouldn't take that little step of acknowledging the divinity of Caesar, because Jesus is Lord. The fundamental Christian confession is Jesus is Lord. If Jesus is Lord, then Caesar isn't. Okay? That's simple. If Jesus is Lord, then Caesar is not Lord. So what happened was Christians started getting persecuted because of their refusal to say the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay? They basically wouldn't cooperate. It was a political thing. The Romans were as broad-minded as pagans can get. All right? They were very broad-minded. They could not care less who you worshipped, right? And also, interestingly, for those of you who are not native English speakers, I couldn't care less and I could care less mean the same thing. A little free English lesson there. Why do we park on driveways and drive on parkways? That's another one. Whoa. So what you have is the Romans couldn't care less if you worship Jesus. Fine, knock yourself out, worship Jesus. What they insisted on, however, was that you give a little pinch of incense to Caesar. That's all you have to do. And the Christians would not do that, and that's where all the persecutions came from. Okay? Now, I'm jumping over centuries here, but what happened in the conversion of Constantine, Constantine finally gave up, and he saw a unity in the Christian church that the Roman Empire didn't have. He put a stop to the pagan sacrifices, which was probably one of the most momentous events in the history of the world, when Constantine said, no more animal sacrifices in the public square. And then all of a sudden, the Christians found themselves, Constantine first allowed Christianity, then he established it as the official religion, and Christians found themselves on prime time before they were ready for prime time. Okay? So there's a difference, and this has happened a couple of times in history. One was when Constantine converted, where the pagan world simply collapsed. The pagan order collapsed and left Christians with an opportunity to govern before the Christians had all the kinks worked out. And they made some blunders and mistakes, but it was still way better than what went before. So some people might say, well, yeah, that was when the church took a downhill turn and Constantine and all that. No. Do you think that it was good? It would have been good if the Roman Empire had continued to kill Christians, if they'd continued to sacrifice to the pagan gods? No, it was an improvement, but it was an improvement in the great cafeteria food fight that was going on. Christians ran the show for the next 1,000 years. The medieval order, I'm collapsing a lot of things. Basically, the Roman Empire continued in the east, in Byzantium, down to the threshold of the modern era. And in the west, it blew up into 100 pieces, and you had little feudal realms and whatnot that coalesced over time into nations and nation states. And by the 1300s, you had nationalism was starting to develop, and then the Reformation hit. And in the Reformation, the same thing happened in England primarily that had happened in the time of Constantine, where the Puritans under Cromwell found themselves running the show again before they were ready for prime time. But it was still way better than what went before. One of the good things that came out of the Puritan Revolution and the Reformation was this idea of limited government. Okay? Now, there are in 1 Timothy, we see what the law, what does law do? Well, law is coercive. Law is not a suggestion. So, we know in 1 Timothy 1, verse 8, but we know that the law is good if a man use it lawfully. So what's the law for? Knowing this, that the law is not made for a righteous man, but for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and for sinners, for unholy and profane, for murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers, for manslayers, for whoremongers, for them that defile themselves with mankind, for men stealers, for liars, for perjured persons, and if there be any other thing that is contrary to sound doctrine, according to the glorious gospel of the blessed God, which was committed to my trust. In the Reformation, a distinction developed where we hammered out what are called the three uses of the law. The three uses of the law. This is one of them. It's to restrain wicked men outside the church. The law gives us information on what sorts of things to say no to, or murder, rape, that kind of evil. The people that are being described here are obviously not people in the church. The law is made to restrain bad guys. Then the second use of the law is the evangelistic use of the law in Galatians. The law was given to teach me that I'm a sinner and that I need forgiveness. So the law convicts me of my sin. That's what brings me to Christ. The third use of the law, and Lutherans and Reformed have different orders of the three uses. They have the same three uses, but sometimes the order varies. The third use of the law is information for the Christian on what love looks like. So if I'm wondering, how do I love my neighbor? I borrowed the lawnmower and it blew up while I was mowing my lawn. What does love look like? Well, I go to the law, and the law tells me that if I borrowed it, I owe him a lawnmower. If he rented it to me, I don't owe him a lawnmower. The law tells me what the duties or obligations of love would be. So you have restraining the wicked, what the cops do when they are restraining violent people. Secondly, evangelistic, and then third, an aid to you in your sanctification. Now, the people he's talking about here, the lawless, disobedient, ungodly, sinners, unholy, profane, murderers of fathers, murderers of mothers, these people need to be sat on. These people, you don't reason sweetly with them. You have to restrain them. The problem is, if you are a thoughtful Christian, you understand that the cops are made out of the same material, right? The cops are fallen. The cops are capable of doing awful things, right? It's not just as our country is blowing up right now because people are taking, they're not taking a biblical view on this at all. They're either saying Black Lives Matter or Blue Lives Matter, and what we ought to be saying is, wait, evidence matters, truth matters, right? If you hear about a shooting where a cop shot somebody, and you have to find out what color everybody was before you know what to think about it, then you are the problem, right? That's the problem. It has. If the colors make a difference, then that is an anti-Christian frame of mind. So the statue of Lady Justice, blindfolded, holding up the scales, is a profoundly biblical, Mosaic, Christian, Sermon on the Mount kind of reality. We want to administer justice as though truth mattered, not my faction, not my party, not my ethnic group, but truth, okay? So we as Christians know that the criminals are sinners, and we know that the cops are sinners. We know that the citizenry are sinners, and we know that the congressmen are also sinners. Everybody's a sinner. Now what do? We have to restrain these bad guys, and the law is given to us to restrain these bad guys, but we also have to restrain the restrainers, don't we? We have to do something about the people who have the guns officially. Now I'm telescoping a lot of history together here, but this was one of the great achievements of the American founding. The American founding was an extraordinary event. Now I need to say something here that's important, because there's a group of nationalistic political conservatives who like to talk about national greatness, and they like to talk about America as an exception. They call it American exceptionalism. All right, America is absolutely unique in the history of the world. Well, when Babylon was on top of their game, they believed in Babylonian exceptionalism. When the Persians were on top of the world, they believed in Persian exceptionalism. When the Romans were, they believed in Roman exceptionalism. When the British ran the world, they believed in British exceptionalism. And at each period when these empires were on top of the world, nobody could imagine any circumstance where that wouldn't be the case, right? When, you know the saying, the sun never sets on the British Empire. Well, that was within living memory. Okay, that was within living memory. When World War II ended, Harry Truman was far more worried about the British than he was about the Soviets. All right, because look at how much territory they have. And so everybody believes in exceptionalism, except the American founders. The American founders knew that an empire, they knew about the mojo that was going to happen here. And they were aware of it, and they knew that Americans were made out of ordinary sinful stuff. And that was exceptional. In other words, the exceptional thing about the American founding is the Constitution baked limited government into our system of government, and they did so because they had a biblical view of man as sinner. That's why. If you sit down and carefully read through the Constitution, the father of the Constitution was Madison. Well, a number of people contributed, but Madison was probably chiefly responsible. Madison had been a student at what is now Princeton under John Witherspoon. Witherspoon was a Scottish Presbyterian minister who had come over from Scotland, and he was the only clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence, and he was the instructor for a number of the founding fathers. If you sit down and read through the American Constitution, you will come away with, let's say you're from Mars and you're reading it. And what is this about? What is this political document? What is it saying? What is it basically trying to get at? The message of the Constitution is this: never, ever trust an American. don't trust an American. We're going to put a little bit of power over here. We're going to put a little bit of power over here. We're going to put some over here. And then we're going to hide some. And we're going to give some power to the states. We're going to give some power to the people. We're going to let the states select the senators, the state legislatures select the senators to the national government. Then we're going to give a little power to the Supreme Court. And then we're going to let Congress limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court according to the cases. Then we're going to give a little bit of power to the president, and we're going to set them on each other to fight it out for the next 200 years, to have squabbles among themselves. This system of checks and balances is profoundly Christian. It's profoundly Christian. It's the most anti-pagan frame of mind that you can imagine, because what dictators, tyrants, North Korean dear leaders, what people like that want is when they express a wish for something to happen, they want no back chat, they want no friction, they want no resistance, they are exasperated by delays. They love the idea of efficiency, right? Here's the problem. There's many problems. My time is one of them. Under Elijah, when Ahab married Jezebel and brought in the Baals, Baal worship, this was done for the sake of fertility. They wanted to make Israel green. They wanted the worship of the God of fertility, and they wanted to make Israel green. So Elijah, shut up, you know, a prophet of God, declared that there wouldn't be any rain. There wasn't rain for 3 years plus. And so Ahab said, let it be green. Jezebel said, let it be green. Elijah said, it will be brown and crispy. Brown and crispy. And then after 3 years, when Ahab meets up with Elijah, he says, is it you, O troubler of Israel? Like, you're the one who caused the trouble here? Well, what this boils down to is that we want to keep the thing that we're worshiping, right? You want to worship the God of green, and we turn it brown. We want to worship the God of liberty, and we find ourselves in chains. Christians go the opposite way. They want to acknowledge the God of the Bible and follow his word. And when they do, they say, okay, we need to trust God and not one another. We need to trust God and not the leader who says, I want efficiency. So this is where my green, brown illustration comes from. The socialist wants, he looks at an American intersection, and he sees four roads going into the intersection. And you know what is on each corner of that intersection? A gas station. A gas station. There's a gas station A and a gas station B and a gas station C and a gas station D. And the socialist says, this is inefficient, it's wasteful, it's awful, it's people are make profiteering. This is, you know, we need to make it efficient and streamlined. We need to bring in the Baals and worship Baal so that we can everything can turn green. We just need one big gas station there, and we're going to mandate it. And it's and in fact, we want the gas to be affordable, so we're going to put price controls on the gas. It's going to be one sleek, fancy gas station, not four, and everybody can have access to it. And then they build this, and they have everything except for gas. No gas. Well, why? Well, because it turns out to produce gas and get it to pump, it costs a certain amount of money. And if you're making them sell it for less than that, the first thing that's going to happen, you're going to run out of gas. Your green Israel is going to turn brown. Okay, but the central thing is not the math mistake or the economics mistake. The problem behind that is the overweening conceit of a man who thinks that he can track all the economic transactions at one intersection, merely one. So if the president of the United States, let's say we continue going down the wrong road, and the president appoints a czar. A gas czar, and he's a gasoline czar for one intersection only. One major city, one intersection only. I can guarantee you that they're going to run out of gas. Because we're finite. We're limited. We're stupid. We're selfish. We need to limit power. And so the whole idea of the government, and this is going to, I'll just mention this and then wrap up, and if you have a question about it, we can pursue it. But this is why, in our documents, we have established a form of government that limits governors, mayors, city councils, congresses, Supreme Courts. We got married 200 years ago, 200 years plus. And before we got married in the civil government, we arranged a prenup agreement. The prenup agreement is called the Constitution. And in the Constitution, there are certain things that you cannot do. All right? One of the things that Congress cannot do, First Amendment, is prohibit gatherings like this, the right to peaceably assemble. They have no right to restrict. They have no right to have someone at the door counting how many people go in, or counting how many people go in and go out without masks, or with or without masks. That's not in the prenup. And I'll just finish with this observation, that because it's in the prenup, because the Constitution, a part of our Christian inheritance, is the supreme law of the land, when I obey the Constitution and disobey a decree from some functionary who's not in his lane, the person who tells me to obey is not obeying Romans 13, and I am obeying Romans 13, because we're supposed to honor the existing authorities. All right, I probably kicked enough shins.